Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Tuesday, August the 31st. As we like to do once a week, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Obviously, a lot of talk about Afghanistan today, and also President Biden. And what happens now to President Biden? His opinion, the opinion polls are dropping considerably. And what happens? What happens to him? What happens to resignations in the military? What happens to terrorism? I mean, it's just a bunch of questions. What happens to the morale of the troops after something like this? I mean, I remember Vietnam, and the morale of the troops was not the best after Vietnam. And this is a lot worse than Vietnam, I think. This is, you know, Vietnam 10 times worse. So let's say hello to our friend Bill Katz. And Bill, give us a weather report. I don't think you're still getting rain there, but give us a weather report.
No, actually, it looks pretty nice outside. The sun is out. The temperatures have been moderate in the last few days. We did not get any real part of the storm as it came up the coast. We seem to have a barrier of some kind in the area in which we're broadcasting from, that we very rarely get weather that meets the horrible expectations of the forecasters. They will be on the air, and it's like a Jackie Mason routine. It's going to be the worst thing. You will never see anything in your life as bad as this. And then you get two drops, three drops maybe, which is four drops more than we got the last time. And Duracell has done well. Food stores have done well. The TV networks, I guess, do well because everybody watches in a storm. But we were barely touched. There was some damage to the east of us on Long Island, and some flooding, I believe, in parts of Connecticut. We got some local flooding on an old highway that has existed since the beginning of time, but that's about it.
Yeah. Well, Louisiana, our neighbor to the east, has been hit very hard. I guess they're still going through it.
Yes.
So I would assume that some parts of East Texas are maybe getting, maybe Houston, for example, is probably getting a little bit of rain. But here in the Dallas area, no, just a lot of the Texas heat that we always get at the end of August. The climate has not changed in Texas for 1,000 years. So I'm assuming that it won't change for another 1,000, but they tell me the world is ending in 10 years. So we better do a lot of shows, Bill, so that we can save them for wherever we go to after the world comes to an end, Bill, because of climate change.
Well, I know. AOC of the Bronx has told us that the world is about to end, and Al Gore is constantly seen with a sandwich sign saying, the end is nigh, but you can buy insurance through me. And what is amazing is one of the things we found in the last year is when people on television say follow the science, run, do not walk away from the television set, because what you're about to hear is probably going to be garbage. Science is very, very complex, and now we have the Democrats are trying to put the Green New Deal into law, so we will spend trillions on dollars based on a theory. And the theory may not work out. So we've always had heavy storms. I remember when I was a little boy, the storm of 1947. I distinctly remember it because when you're seven, you remember things from then.
Mm-hmm.
How unbelievably tall the snowbanks were. I mean, and they would clear sidewalks, and on each side of the sidewalk, the snowbanks were so high that a little seven-year-old like me would walk through them, and it was like walking between two mountains. We have always had disasters, and they will say, for example, that Hurricane Sandy was the second worst storm in the history of New York, and it's because of climate change. And so the question is, if somebody says something is the second worst, what you want to know is, well, when was the worst? It turned out to have been 1826, before the Industrial Revolution. There were no smokestacks. There were no cars guzzling or spouting pollution, and that was the worst. So I don't know how they explain that one.
Well, I'm sure there was one worse before that too. I'm sure there was one in whatever, maybe the year that the Indians sold Manhattan. The British, maybe there was a terrible storm that year. Who knows? But, yeah, I do think they get a little bit exaggerated. I mean, they cannot tell you what the temperature – I mean, they make mistakes about predictions a week from now, but then they want us to believe what's going to happen 10 years from now. You know, I think – I was thinking with climate change. Now, you mentioned climate change. I had an idea with climate change. Why don't we take – why don't we select one state, let's say California, and implement – every one of those ideas in California and wait 10 years and see what happens. If it all works, okay, hey, there's something to look into. But if it doesn't work, at least you're not screwing up the whole country. So let's turn California into, I don't know, into an experiment on climate change and give it a try there, Bill.
That's a good idea. Another, absolutely. And you know what's interesting about the way they present this stuff, the climate change fanatics, and they're a thoughtful climate change scientists. We should point that out, who actually, you know, take it seriously and make careful predictions. But it's a win-win for them. If the world in 25 years starts disappearing and, you know, Los Angeles is flooded and New York disappears, okay, they were right. We said they were right. But if everything goes well and nothing bad happens, they will say it's because of all the steps we took, all the little steps we took, like driving 5 miles rather than 6 miles. All those little things added up. We were right. That's why the world was saved. They cannot lose.
Right. Well, it's the typical people who make predictions. I mean, they're very rarely held accountable. I remember one time George Steinbrenner, the owner of the Yankees, was answering some questions from the press because the Yankees were not doing well and, you know, people were getting on Steinbrenner for his predictions that the Yankees were going to be in the postseason or whatever. And Steinbrenner said, you know, you're holding me accountable for my predictions. What about holding you guys accountable for all your predictions?
Well, that's right.
You've all made a bunch of predictions that didn't come true, but we're not talking about them. We're talking – so, I mean, a lot of these people who make predictions – maybe the same standards should apply to them. I agree with you. I think there's a lot of thoughtful people, a lot of very dedicated people who look at the climate and see problems. And they look, I want clean air as much as anybody. But if you're telling me we're going to shut down the entire industry in the United States and ship it to China so that our air is not polluted, well, and then on top of that, we're going to raise the electricity rates for families. And then on top of that, we're going to force everybody to buy a battery, but we don't have enough power plants to drive electric cars. How is that a win? Can somebody explain to me how that makes life better, Bill?
Well, it makes it better for the people who are in those industries, that's for sure.
Well, that's it.
And we know that during the Obama administration and the Clinton administration, maybe, there were companies that were selling this climate change stuff, and the world is going to run out of everything, and they were selling the solar panels and this and that. But and those things have really not made that much difference. And as far as things like wind farms, people don't realize that wind farms give off an enormous amount of noise pollution, and apparently that was not taken into consideration. So, before we invest trillions of dollars that we need elsewhere, and trillions of dollars we don't have, I mean, everything is being done now by borrowed money, and they think it's just wonderful to borrow the money and let the next generation fend for itself. Before we do that, maybe we ought to listen to some of the more thoughtful climate scientists who say, look, you know, there may be a rise in temperature, but the world is not going to come to an end. Civilization is not going to come to an end. And it is not right that we scare people. And some very prominent scientists have said that.
I take my advice from that noted climate change expert, former President Barack Obama, who just bought a house by the ocean. I have to believe
that's right.
That if former president, climate change premier, specialist, Barack Obama, thought that the world was going to end in 10 years, that he would have never bought a house next to the ocean. I mean, why would he do that? That'd be a pretty bad investment, Bill, wouldn't it?
It would have been a very bad investment, but Barack Obama believes he is godlike and believes that he is better than the rest of us. There was a rating a few days ago, and now I cannot remember who did it, but I think it's coming from a new book by Kessler. And he goes back and talked to the staffs on an anonymous basis of the last five or six or seven American presidents and what they thought of the people they were serving. And the results were pretty much what you would think, in some cases devastating, like Jimmy Carter. But I had known somebody who worked in the White House when Carter was there, and he said he was intensely disliked by the staff. And Obama apparently was very disliked, especially her. At least in the book, that's what the book will say, that people felt that she was just, a tremendous egotist and didn't like people, et cetera, et cetera. The one who was liked most of all, and it's entirely understandable, was Reagan. The staff, the people in the White House loved Reagan. He acted like a real person to them. Of course, Hillary Clinton gets the worst reviews, but we kind of knew that already, that she was a very, very difficult person to deal with. But the thing is that, in the case of Obama, one of the things that has absolutely horrified me about the American press is that during the pandemic, Obama bought that mansion in Massachusetts, and not one reporter came up to him and said, "Mr. Obama, aren't you concerned about the appearances of this?" You know, in a way, he's a former president buying a mansion during a national crisis and spending $17 million that he made by monetizing the presidency and making all these deals with film and television companies. But nobody ever challenged him on anything. People are afraid. They're afraid that if they challenge him, people will yell racism, and people don't want to be called racist. But his behavior in terms of that mansion and in terms of the big party he wanted to have there recently, which had to be scaled down because of all the criticism, I think tells me a lot about him, the man, and it's not favorable.
That's it. I mean, if you believe, like you were saying, if you believe in climate change and all this stuff, but then you buy a mansion by the lake and by the water and you spend all that kind of money. Money he didn't have when he became president. I mean, he wrote a few books, and I'm sure he made some money from that. But he's become a pretty popular, person since he left the White House. I mean, these movie stars basically treat him like another movie star, I guess. He's like the Charlton Heston of Hollywood.
Yes.
And, everywhere he goes, I remember Charlton Heston one time saying that every time he went out to eat, somebody wanted to pay his dinner,
Right.
Because everybody loved him, and that's kind of the way Obama is. Well, a lot of news about Afghanistan, Bill, this week. That's our primary topic. And maybe we should begin with the fact that President Biden is going to speak to the nation today once again in the afternoon when nobody's watching television. And he's going to be speaking to the nation about I guess he's going to explain how it ended. And I don't know about you, Bill, but I don't have a lot of expectations that a lot of people are going to watch or that he's going to be very persuasive. Maybe I'm just being a little harsh, Bill.
I think that you're not being harsh at all. What has amazed me during this episode is the fact that the press has been so tough on Biden. I didn't expect him to be that way. Now, some are holdouts from the hard left, and they will interpret all this as some kind of a victory for civilization. But most of the reporters have been very tough on Biden, on his explanations, which have clearly not impressed anyone, on the actual images that we see, on the humiliation of the United States, and on the probability that this will give bad guys around the world a great boost in their prestige and in their morale, and they may see this as an opportunity to do further bad things and with the expectation of not being caught or not being stopped. I'm very concerned about this report. We ran it on Urgent Agenda this morning about the North Koreans increasing their nuclear capacity, according to the international agency at the UN that monitors these things, and that there is great concern that they're going back to a very active nuclear weapons production program. I'm very concerned about the Iranians, who no longer seem interested in any negotiation with us on anything, while they build missiles designed to carry nuclear weapons and also go further in their nuclear development. I think we're in a lot of trouble, and I think we're in a situation where allies are looking at us and asking the question, can the United States be trusted? And the answer that is coming back is no. The Europeans are appalled. They really are. Why? Because of, well, in a way, it's their kind of nature. They know they depend on us. We can talk about NATO from now until Sunday. NATO means basically the United States and all the others. We are the ones who are the rock of NATO. And I think that they could understandably be saying, as time goes on, will another American president abandon us if the Russians put the heat on in some part of Europe? So,
yeah.
I think we're going to probably see an easing of the pressure on China from Western nations. They will say, look, we have to get along with the Chinese because nobody's going to stop them. I think the people of Taiwan must really be nervous at this point. After all, Taiwan is an island off the coast of China. It is the remnant of free China. And it is the communist government in Beijing has made it very clear they want Taiwan under their administration, under their control. They regard Taiwan as part of China. Now, if you were in a situation like that and you just saw the United States capitulate to a bunch of ragtag terrorists, and you know that the Taiwanese will need American help to defend Taiwan if Taiwan is invaded by China, you might be tempted to take the chance. You might be tempted to say, let's go. We'll probably win. We may get some sanctions thrown on us that will mean nothing because the American corporate community likes to do business with China, and we'll have Taiwan. And that's
right.
What I'm afraid of. So,
well, there will be some
war
sanctions and some Twitter hashtags, you know. Some Twitter hashtags about stand with the people of Taiwan. And the people in Taiwan are going to look at that and say, well, thanks for the message, but doesn't really stop the Chinese who are invading us, you know. But, Bill, I wanted to say one thing about the Europeans and Afghanistan. I saw this over the weekend, that many Europeans are worried about this, because they believe that they're going to be flooded with refugees.
Very much so.
You know, it's a lot easier to get to Paris from Afghanistan than to New York or to Dallas, because at least they got to cross the ocean if they want to come to, you know, our cities. But all you got to do is somehow get to Turkey and you'll get to Paris because of the train or whatever they have over there. And a lot of them are concerned about that. And if you remember, Bill, when President Obama took the troops out of Iraq, and that sort of turned on ISIS in that region, they had the same problem. The Italians were constantly getting boats of refugees
across, I guess, that's
the shortest place to cross. And that's what they're afraid of, that they're afraid now they're going to get tons of refugees at a time when you've got a pandemic and at a time when their economies are shut down or not operating in full capacity. So that's also what they're worried about, is refugees coming over, and you've got to believe there are going to be some refugees. If they can get to Turkey, they're home free, Bill.
They are, and I think another thing that is of great concern is the so-called vetting process. Presumably, we are being told each refugee from Afghanistan is being carefully vetted. I don't buy that for a minute. How do you vet somebody you've never met before? You know, what do you say? We want your FBI report. Give me a note from your teacher in school that you're a good boy? I mean, I think we're going to get in a lot of bad people. It doesn't take that many. Remember 9/11 was carried out by how many people? About 16?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take that many. We are already, we assuming, getting some bad people from across the southern border and the breakdown of border security. If you were a terrorist wanting to come into the United States, that would be a very good way of doing it. But I
well,
think
sure.
you're absolutely right.
No, and, you're and sure. I mean, the border is what you wrote about this, I think, yesterday. The border
sure.
is a real vulnerability right now because
absolutely.
Look, people can get through that border. I mean, we're stopping people, but if you really want to get through there, you can. And I hope that this goes into the equation of border security, but this administration apparently doesn't think the United States needs to have a border because over a million people have come into the country over the last 7 or 8 months. These people are not vaccinated. They're not. We have no idea who they are. They're coming from countries with big COVID problems, and yet they've come in, and then they call you a racist if you ask the question, well, are these people vaccinated? Oh, you're a racist. You're blaming COVID on the people crossing the border. And I'm saying, I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just making a reasonable assumption that if a million people come from parts of the world that have serious COVID problems, it's only safe to assume that some of them have COVID, Bill.
Absolutely. You have to assume it. And what you can also assume is that countries other than Afghanistan will participate in this. We should realize that Afghanistan in part borders on two countries, Pakistan and Iran. Iran. Now, I have no doubt that in the precincts of the foreign ministry in Tehran, which is an excellent foreign ministry, by the way, the Persians are historically good negotiators, that they are saying, how can we use this? And I think they can use it by coming to the United States and saying, if you want us to secure our borders against terrorists from the Taliban in Afghanistan, we want to make a deal with you. No more pressure on our nuclear program, no more this, no more that. And I think we're going to be in a very difficult situation. They can open themselves to those terrorists, take them in, and train them further. And,
that's right.
And they can demand a very high price from us not to do it. And Pakistan, of course, is always portrayed as a kind of ally of the United States. It is not an ally of the United States. They have been supporting the Taliban. The reporting by Laura Logan, who is just wonderful, and one of the most outspoken and fearless reporters we have, is that Pakistan is basically on their side, and we have really known it, but we don't say it. So
right.
we're in a tough jam right now. We have to reestablish our credibility, while enemy nations are testing that credibility in ways they may not have tested it before. We may not be ready for this. Our armed forces may not be ready for this. I don't think anyone is overwhelmed with the leadership of the armed forces and the leadership of the Pentagon. And we also have pressure from within this country on the political left to cut our defense budget, not to expand it, but to cut it. We
That's
also
right.
have pressure in some cities to defund the police, even though it has proved to be in the polling one of the most unpopular issues ever to be presented to the American people. There are people in large cities, including, by the way, the new lieutenant governor of New York, who continue to believe in defunding the police because in their narrow constituency, it's a popular issue. So we are in very bad shape. I hesitate to say we've never been here before because there are always examples you can use. But after Vietnam, America was laughed at. It really was. People say, you know, they abandoned people they fought with. They did not win the war. Actually, militarily, I think we did win the war, and I think that is widely acknowledged. It was lost in the post-negotiation process where we just didn't have the morale and the willpower to help the Vietnamese any further. And people forget that we cut off aid, military aid, in the mid-1970s, maybe a little earlier than that, to people who had helped us. And President Ford at the time called it an action of extreme dishonor. Congress would not fund even helping the Vietnamese after they fought side by side with us for years. And there was a slogan that did come out, a saying that did come out during that period, that one of the worst things you can be in the world is an ally of the United States. So we have gone through a little bit of this before, and the only thing that saved us was Ronald Reagan. And that's
right.
true.
That's right. Let me take a little break, Bill, because when I come back, I want to talk a little bit about the impact of all of this politically and also more conversation about foreign policy. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Just a quick reminder that the music that we hear on the podcast is the music of Carlos Guedes, my good friend from Venezuela. I have a link on the show information if you want to check out some of his very good music. He's got a lot of different styles that he performs. Let's get back to Bill. Bill, I wanted to sort of put it this way, what my position about Afghanistan is, or was, I guess, and that is that I always supported maintaining a military presence, maybe a military base that allowed us to fly in and fly out, like the one that we lost. And the reason is not because I believe in endless wars, which has now become a popular phrase, is because I know for a fact over the last 30 or 40 years since that first attack in Munich at the Olympics, that these people are in the business of terrorism. And when we get out, they don't get out. We may choose to get out, but they continue following us. And, you know, none of these people ever get out of the business of terrorism and start writing a blog or doing a podcast. They always stay in terrorism, Bill. It's a little bit like the mafia. You can never get out once you're in. So, yeah,
that's
we
right.
may be out of this. I mean, I see this headline in the Dallas Morning News today. I'm going to call the paper and ask them why they printed this headline, America's Longest War is Over. Well, let's see what that looks like a year from now, Bill, because on the other side, the war is not over for them, Bill. They're celebrating this as a battle victory, and I guarantee you they're planning for more stuff, Bill.
I'll give you a piece of history. Do you know that after the Second World War in Europe, in the first years after the Second World War, 1,000 American soldiers were killed in terrorist acts? People don't know that. They really are not aware of it. And it got so bad that Eisenhower, who was presiding over the occupation, went to Konrad Adenauer, whom we had basically placed in power in Germany after the Second World War. He was anti-Nazi. And he read him the riot act, and he said, if this continues, you're out. And now Adenauer was anti-Nazi. He was anti-terror. But yet, as a German, he knew pretty much who was involved in this. And it stopped. He was able to get it stopped. But I'm almost reminded of those stories, switching from the European theater to the Pacific theater for a moment, those stories that we read in the 1950s and even into the 1960s of Japanese soldiers who came out of the hills and out of the forest still thinking World War II was on and still ready to fight. It's a little bit like that, but you're absolutely right. The terrorists have an ideology. They believe in that ideology. They also believe they will eventually win. We have just given them some encouragement in that direction, unfortunately. But terrorism is a continuing threat. It's particularly a threat to Muslims themselves, as we've seen in the horror of the last few weeks in Afghanistan and the horror that many people believe will come to Afghanistan. And because they are ideologists, they are not given to the notion that if we lose a little bit in one place, that our struggle is over. The struggle just continues. And we saw last week with this terrible terror incident near the airport where 13 Americans were killed and many, many Afghans, the sheer power of the bombs that can be carried by one person. That was an enormous, enormous explosion. And I've never seen one person kill that many people at one time. And we have to be on guard in America and on guard for the possibility that they will try another 9/11.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you would think that if you're the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador in many European capitals, I hope they've raised their terrorism threat index or whatever they call it, because that would be the easiest place to hit the United States right now. Again, we're lucky that we're separated by an ocean. They can always come in through the border, granted. But the easiest targets would be American embassies in Europe, American facilities, schools, whatever, in Europe. And that's what I'm hoping, that the people who run these places are taking this very seriously, Bill. I hope they are. I hope so. I hope the word is out that, hey, you know, you may be hit by a terrorist, so please be extra careful in how you run your daily operations, Bill.
That's right. Well, there are certain countries that we know will be taking it very seriously. Certainly Israel, obviously, will be taking it seriously. I suspect France will be taking it very seriously. We tend to underestimate the French when it comes to national security. They took the attacks on them very seriously in the 1980s. They had some very, very bad ones, and you would go to airports in France and you would find soldiers with machine guns. They did set up some important and impressive facilities. Other countries, I don't know. I think if there's a new conservative government, if it is elected in Canada, that they will take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. Will we take it seriously? I think most Americans will, but many in critical places will not. Remember, when Obama came to office, he wanted to eliminate the word terror. He wanted to change it to man-made disasters. There's a whole faction in the United States that is probably not terribly upset about what has just happened. They probably think America got what it deserved. And these are people who don't think these are terrorists. They think they're freedom fighters who may do some bad things, but they do it because they are oppressed, very oppressed, and we have to understand them. And there are people like that in the United States government and in our universities teaching our children. And we must understand that what we do internally will have an enormous effect on what we do in foreign policy. It
Absolutely.
Always has had.
Yes. I was going to say one quick thing. Go ahead and finish. I was going to say one quick thing. You mentioned Canada. And Prime Minister Trudeau, I guess a couple of weeks ago, was feeling pretty good and decided to call for a new election. He may regret that, because you're right.
Yes.
Some of the polling data shows that the conservatives may come back. And you may remember this, Bill, not to get off on Canada, but you may remember that the last election, Prime Minister Trudeau was reelected, but he actually lost the popular vote. It was one of those based on the number of parliament seats or whatever. So I don't think he's ever been really that popular. And I know that particularly the provinces to the west, you know, west of Ontario, they're super conservative. And maybe that'll be a change. I mean, I'm not going to miss Trudeau if he goes, Bill.
No, we didn't miss his father either. His father was anti-American. I think he's just a little nicer about it than his father was. His father was also a social flirt. Remember Margaret Trudeau and the parties they had. But yes, I think Canada is in danger. I think South Korea is in danger. I don't know how they would respond to a situation like this. And I think Britain is certainly in danger. Remember the Islamic terrorists despised the British because they were the great colonial power. And I think they are in danger. I mean, it was very, very interesting to see the way the Prime Minister of Britain, Boris Johnson, was so critical of the United States. That is usually not language you hear from a British Prime Minister, but he was very plain in saying this is America's fault. And I think that we may start seeing initiatives in Europe that don't involve the United States and don't include the United States. Now, it will be spun here by the Democratic Party is saying, well, that's exactly what we want. We want them to take control of their own security and this and that. Well, it won't be because they want to. It will be because they feel they have to. And the United States may be kept out of things. There was a story. I don't know if it's true. I can't confirm it. But it sounds one of these things that sounds true, that when Biden came into office, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel cut off some of the intelligence information that was being supplied to the United States on the grounds that he didn't feel Biden could be trusted. Now, if that's true, that's a devastating action. And I think you're going to see from this point on that Britain, some of our leading intelligence partners, will be a little reluctant to share some information because they can't be sure the United States is secure. This is going to have ramifications in many areas.
Yeah. You know, they maybe they'll kick us out of the Paris Climate Change Accord because they'll say, you guys are showing us up. You've met all the standards and none of us have. So we're going to kick you out of the agreement. Maybe they'll do that, Bill.
Well, they might, and you can be sure that Biden will blame it on Donald. What was his name? Crump or something?
That's right, Trump. Yeah,
I don't remember.
That's right.
Yeah,
number 45. Yeah.
I am awaiting with quite breathlessly the announcement from the White House that they're putting Kamala Harris in charge of counterterrorism.
That's right. Well, now that she's back in town, Bill, she's apparently back in town. She was in Vietnam.
Yes.
Where she told children to, I guess parents, to do their shopping early because of supply chain problems.
Yes.
She came back, and apparently she's not going to do the campaign stop with Governor Newsom. She's going to fly by. I think she is back in Washington now, and I would not be surprised at all if today President Biden names her, considering what a great job she's done on the border. She will now be named responsible for terrorism, whatever the word is.
Yes.
They will name her that, and I'm sure she'll sit back there and with that mask on and nod her head in approval, Bill.
The mystery in Washington is why she is treated so badly by Biden. I mean, when she came into office, he said she will be the most important vice president in history. And so far, she's basically been an errand girl, does not seem to have much influence in decisions, and is constantly subjected to ridicule, even from within the government, and he does nothing about it. I don't think he has said anything to reassure the public that he has confidence in her, and she is one heartbeat away from the presidency. And it is perfectly evident to people that Biden is not in good shape. The whole Kamala Harris thing is a mystery.
It is.
And maybe he feels resentful that he had to put her on the ticket.
Or it's a mystery because, you know, it's a problem, I should say, more than a mystery, because you're right. I mean, President Biden does not look well. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't want to touch too much of that except to say that he looks to me like a 78-year-old man who has a job that is too intense and simply not the kind of responsibility that we normally give a 78-year-old man. I mean, that's not usually the job, you know, we put somebody of that age on. It's just simply not, it's just too much. And he looks tired. You wonder, how is he sleeping? How is he dealing with all of this? I mean, he's not making many public appearances, that's for sure. And when he does, he doesn't look good at all. I mean, he looks to me, maybe he looks, I don't know. I don't know this for a fact. Maybe this is the way FDR looked at the end
Yes.
of 1944 and at the beginning of 1945. Maybe this is how he looked back then. I don't know for a fact because we didn't have all the coverage we now have. But that was the last time we had a president, I think, in that kind of condition, Bill.
You're absolutely correct, and I think it's a very important analogy. When President Roosevelt began to fade in 1944, there was a 1944 presidential election, and he was going to run for a fourth term. It was obvious to people around him that he was dying, that he was in very, very bad shape. Now, at those days, did not discuss the health of the president. It was considered a private matter, and his doctors, therefore, made no public statements. The people who recognized that he was in bad shape, however, got working because they realized that the vice president of the United States during World War II, Henry Wallace, could not be on the ticket in 1944 because Roosevelt would likely not survive a new term, and Wallace was considered much too far to the left politically to succeed to the presidency. And they got together, and it was really the leaders of Congress who chose Harry Truman to our great benefit. to be, in effect, the next president of the United States. And President Roosevelt won the election in 1944. It was closer than the other elections, but he did win. He was re-inaugurated on January 20th, and on April 12th, just months later, he died. Mm-hmm. And Harry Truman did, in fact, become president. And even though at the time the country was absolutely stunned, Roosevelt was the only president many people ever knew because he had been elected four times. And they didn't know Harry Truman well. He was actually a very well-known senator, but they didn't. The people didn't know him that well. And some people called him the little man from Missouri. He was not the little man from Missouri. He was actually an impressive senator. And there was great uncertainty in the country when Truman came into office. But over time, people came to respect him. He won the 1948 election with that whistle-stop campaign, but he left office with only a 23% approval rating. Yet he is now recognized as one of our most important presidents.
Yeah.
So we have had an experience like this before, but we were ready for it and ready for the death of President Roosevelt because patriots in Washington would not allow a man they regarded as improper to serve in the presidency, and more power to them.
Yes, and this is something that puzzles me a little bit. I mean, if it seems to me that not only President Biden is older and looks tired, but the people around him are not very good. Because you would think that people around him would have said, no, Mr. President, you really cannot do this in Afghanistan. You cannot close that air base. In other words, you could have had people around him to influence him to have ended this better. I cannot believe that Secretary of State Blinken, who may not survive all of this because of resignation. I mean, I think some of these people are going to have to resign. I really do, especially if we start seeing atrocities in Afghanistan against the people who worked with us. God forbid they don't do anything to Americans, but you know how do you control the Taliban? I don't think you can. And who knows what they're going to do to women? All this stuff is going to be seen by the world, and that's just going to make President Biden and his cabinet look worse. But you would think that some of these people would have forced Biden to make a different decision. I think if they had put pressure on Biden, maybe this would have turned out to be a lot different, Bill. I really do. And that's the difference, I think, with Truman and with Kamala Harris, that at least you could trust the people around Truman. I'm not sure how prepared Kamala Harris – I mean, what are they even telling Kamala Harris what's going on? Is she getting a briefing about what's going on? I don't know, Bill. It worries me that she may walk right in and walk into a situation where she honestly doesn't know what's going on, Bill. Not because I'm not saying she's stupid. I'm not saying that. But I don't think she's being prepared for that reality, Bill.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, foreign policy is something where you really do need some experience before you take over the foreign policy of the United States. If you don't have that experience, the State Department will gobble you up and run its own foreign policy. And I fully agree that there is no evidence that she has the experience. There's no evidence she has the training. There's no evidence they're telling her anything. I don't know what they're telling her. Apropos of that, we should point out that one of the failures of the American press when administrations change is that they concentrate on the appointment of cabinet officers, but do not concentrate on the appointment of assistant secretaries. It is on that level where the daily policy is made and carried out. And we have some real whoppers in the State Department, and I think a few in the Defense Department, whose backgrounds do not give me much encouragement. They
Yes.
tend to be these, you know, Palestinian rights activists and this and that. And I think that I think a lot will depend in the next 4 or 5 months on two things in this country. One is the virus, and whether we can bring the new strains under control. But another thing will be the economy. We have an election in November, 2 months, basically 2 months from now. We will elect a governor in Virginia. Many people are unaware that there are some off-year elections for governor. We will elect a lot of state officials. We have on September 14th a recall election in California, which may or may not go well for our side. But all that is happening now is going to have an impact on the way people vote. But I don't know how we can measure that impact.
Yeah. Well, it's a little early, I think, for November, but I do recall back in 2009, Bill, that President Obama's popularity started to decline in the fall and then he lost that election in Virginia, and that was seen as sort of a turning point. A lot of that was Obamacare back then and discussions of Obamacare. But I want to talk a little bit about what happens now, Bill, because I don't know how in the world nobody's going to be held accountable for what happened there. I mean, so there needs to be resignations or dismissals. President Biden is now looking at a political map that is totally different. His approval ratings are way down. He was at 45% at Rasmussen yesterday. I tend to like that poll because it's a daily tracking poll, and they've been good over the years, but he's at 41 in some other polls. So let's just say for the sake of the example that he's at 45. Well, that's not going to make a lot of Democrats happy when they have to run for reelection, because it isn't just Afghanistan, Bill. It's the price of gasoline. You mentioned the economy.
Yes.
I mean, that is a killer, the price of gasoline and what that's doing to people. I mean, every time you fill up your tank, you're reminded that you used to pay a lot less when Trump was president. Fair or unfair, but that's the way people think. And then you have the situation on the border where, you know, they're telling you on one hand that everybody has to get vaccinated. I'm vaccinated. I'm in the interest of disclosure, I was vaccinated completely in April. But they're telling everybody, you got to get vaccinated. It's a matter of life and death, but apparently the border, it doesn't apply. So there's a lot of these issues that he had before Afghanistan, and now comes Afghanistan. I don't know where he goes. I don't think a resignation of the president is likely. I don't think a 25th Amendment is likely. But who knows? By October, I could be completely wrong, Bill. So it's going to be very difficult for President Biden. I guess that's what I'm trying to say in a long-winded sort of way, Bill.
It will be very difficult. He and the Democratic Party, remember, there is that branch of the party that is fanatical, the left wing. We see it here in New York. They're going right ahead with their plans. They're going right ahead with their ideas, their anti-police ideas, in some cases their anti-American ideas. And yet around the country, people are in revolt, sometimes in open revolt, against some of those ideas. One issue I'd like to bring up, and that I think will have an impact electorally in this country, is education. There is a parents' revolt going on. I'm sure you saw the story a few days ago that the number of children attending public schools is way down from a year before, and that parents are trying to find alternatives. Now, it's not all parents, but it is many parents, and many of them will not send their children to school if the schools continue to teach this crazy left-wing stuff and call it education. And there could be just enough parents to make a difference in a lot of races. I think education is going to be one of the biggest issues in this country in the upcoming years, and educators are going to be challenged, and they often act very badly when they're challenged, and we could really have a collapse or a near collapse of the public school system in many areas as parents opt out.
Well, and the initially, of course, here in Texas, we're seeing that. I think the national number, the percentage of kids in the country who are attending homeschooling is it's just slightly over 10%, which I didn't believe it was that high, Bill, when I saw the figure. I said to myself, come on, you got to reconfirm that. It cannot be that high. It is 10%. That's a national number. And more parents, I saw something the other day here in Plano, in Plano, Texas. A father got up and said, if you force my kid to wear a mask, I'm taking him out of the school. And a bunch of parents applauded. So I've got to believe there's other parents who would do the same thing. If they take him out of the school, where do they put him? Well, let's say they keep him at home. But you have to wonder, when do those parents start saying, I'm not going to pay the property taxes for public schools? I'm teaching my own kids. I want the benefit of the property taxes that I'm paying for my kids or to do something else with my kids. So I see school choice as a big issue as well in 2022. And you may remember this, Bill. Last week there was a major Democrat in California who endorsed Larry Elder. And this lady said, I'm endorsing him because our schools are a disaster and we need school choice. That's a Democrat. I think she probably speaks for a ton of Democrats who feel the same way, Bill.
I think you're absolutely correct. And with school choice, must come, and the Republicans will propose this and will fight for it, school vouchers, which means answering your issue about people paying the taxes, the school tax, and not getting anything for it because they won't send the kids to that school, that the system will be changed in such a way that you will get a voucher to send your child to another school. I think that's a great idea. I think it's an idea that's going to spread, and I think it's an idea that has very great political value because children want the best, or I'm sorry, parents want the best for their children. They don't think they're getting the best in the public school system. They're regularly subjected to insults by school administrators and by teachers. We see one after the other these stories of teachers doing crazy things in classrooms. And I do believe that's going to change over time. You know, we have an army of mothers in this country that are willing to fight for their kids. And
right.
I would not want to get in their way.
No,
really
not right now, because they are angry. And they have a right to be angry, Bill. I mean, I don't have kids in school age, I mean, at that level anymore. But I would be very angry if my kids came home and were showing me some of the stuff they're learning. I would be angry if I was turned on the computer and they're being taught to hate the country. I would be very angry. I mean, I love the United States. I know firsthand what this country means. I know that firsthand. You know, this weekend we had a special celebration for our parents, you know, because we have family in different states. We managed to get everybody together, and we had a big celebration on Saturday. We had a big program for my parents, and you know, everybody got up to speak, and every family member, you know, not just me, but grandsons and everybody got up, granddaughters, everybody spoke. And it was amazing to me when they spoke about my parents, how much they spoke about the fact that they came here and started a new life and all of that. So we know what this country is for. And anybody who hates this country, well, I'm going to have a problem with that, and especially if they're teaching my children. So I hope that these legislators or the Democrats take seriously school choice, because I think it's coming. If they keep if they don't break with the teachers union, or at least come up with a different arrangement, I think the Democrats are going to have a serious problem in 2022. But one thing I wanted to say for last, Bill, as we're running out of time, I don't like to be unfair with President Biden. Maybe he has a habit of checking his watch. Sometimes men do that. You know, sometimes men do that. They have a habit of checking their watch or I don't know, whatever. But what a terrible time to do it, Bill, when you have coffins passing by him. I know some of the parents of these young men are furious. And
yes.
I mean, President Biden doesn't seem to get a break, I guess. Starting to remind me of President Carter, who just never got a break with anything, Bill.
Well, in politics, you know, you have to create your own breaks. And doing something it was probably an automatic gesture. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think Biden is indifferent to the lives of Americans. But remember, this happened during George H.W. Bush's administration,
mm-hmm.
when during a presidential debate he was seen glancing at his watch, and he was pounced upon by the opposition for being indifferent to the debate, not caring what the American people think. And you can, yes, looking at a gesture like that, I believe that at one time, in fact, I do remember that during the Obama administration, the president was boarding a helicopter and he forgot to salute the Marine at the bottom, which is only a gesture of respect. It's not required, and he got back. He went into the helicopter and he went back and he saluted the Marine, and he had enough common sense to know to do that.
Right. No, and as I agree with you, I don't think President Biden, I'm sure he was moved and emotionally involved in all of this. I mean, who wouldn't be? How would you not be emotionally involved if there's a coffin in front of you of a 21-year-old Marine whose wife is going to have a baby in 3 weeks? You have to be moved, and I'm sure he was. But again, looking at that watch, I don't know. It compounds the problem. And what can I say? It's not going to get any better, unfortunately, for President Biden and, of course, the rest of us in the country. Bill, as always, thank you for your time. It's great to talk to you again. Keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda. And I look forward to the next time. I have a funny feeling that we'll be talking about some of these issues next week. Let's see how the Taliban in Afghanistan behaves this next week, because if they do what I think they're going to do, this topic is going to be on for a few more months, Bill.
I think so. I fully agree.
Yeah. Have a wonderful week. I was going to say one thing before I forget. You mentioned 1947 earlier in the show, and there was a bad storm in 1947. Wasn't that the year, from reading my baseball history, that the DiMaggio hit that ball to center field and that great catch by the Dodger center fielder?
Cookie Labichetto. Yes, I think it was 1947. I'd have to look it up, but it was in that era where and what the wonderful picture or the movie of DiMaggio rounding second base and realizing then that the shot had been caught and expressing frustration, but so gracefully. It was a very graceful play.
Yeah, DiMaggio knew how to do that.
Yep.
Well, when you mentioned 1947 and I thought about Brooklyn, it just something in my head said, oh, that was the year that DiMaggio hit that ball. And I think it was. I'm pretty sure that it was, because in 47, the Dodgers and the Yankees were in the series. So it's got to be 47.
Yes. Yes, they were. And I remember listening to the series on a small Emerson radio, tabletop radio that we had with tubes, and sitting next to my grandmother. So
and what did she say
well.
About that catch? You remember?
I don't recall her ever having any interest in baseball at all.
Okay, all right. Well, that happens with many grandmothers, so you're not alone.
Yes.
You're not alone on that one. Have a great week, Bill, and we'll chat again next time.
Thank you, Sylvia.
All right, thank you very much. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, and a big fan of the Brooklyn Dodgers, as you've heard before. There's a fellow at our church who's also a huge fan of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Actually, he was a Yankee fan during that time, and I chat with him often about baseball and that golden era of baseball in the 1950s. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.